Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast, where we connect with educators from across the globe who are creating a better future for learning and educating now by implementing bold ideas and fostering a sense of curiosity, creativity, and possibility.
Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast. I'm your co-host, Josh Faden, here with my other co-host, Michael Carson.
Hello.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Josh.
And we are thrilled to be joined with today Kelsey Payne from Altitude Learning. She is the head of partnerships with Altitude Learning. She also was a former teacher, and so brings her knowledge and expertise to the field, as well as working in different aspects of coaching into the field of education, and learner-centered model enthusiast, I might say, as well. So again, Kelsey, we're thrilled to have you here, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi guys, great to be here. Excited to dive in.
Excellent. So Kelsey, just first off, tell us a little bit about, you know, your background and your origin story, if you will, in education, how you got to Altitude Learning and the steps that kind of got you here along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm originally an East Coast girl, born and raised in New Jersey, but always had this deep-seated love for California, the California lifestyle, and truly feel like I was a California girl from the start. So I made my way almost there for college. I went to Arizona State. I have early beginnings as a dance teacher and knew I always wanted to be an educator of some sort. So really focused on that at Arizona State. And then the other thing that started bubbling up for me was this love of teaching reading. So I went right into my master's and made it all the way to California at the University of San Francisco and got my master's in teaching reading. So, you know, a little bit of a movement background with dance and then a little bit of this, love of reading on the other hand. And so when I entered into the classroom, I started as a first grade teacher. So the, you know, learning or teaching students how to read was at the forefront of the work that I was doing. And then that coincided with my love of movement. So my classroom was very, whole body movement, energy throughout the day. I started to realize as I was doing my, my teaching and exploring what my philosophy was as an educator, I started to realize that there was so much more than, let's just say, like some of the canned curriculum or traditional model that I was given to serve my students. And so things, some of the buzzwords that started bubbling up for me were like holistic education or whole child learning. And I started to feel like I was learning these things in real time, but really wanted to understand the research behind it of what my students were bringing into the classroom, how this kind of wraparound approach was allowing them to excel in all spaces, not just the specific reading intervention or just the one math quiz, but that they were excelling as a whole. And so I made my way, back to San Francisco. And I'm currently back at the University of San Francisco getting my doctorate in education. So really focusing on that same learner-centered, now called learner-centered movement. And then, tried to find an organization that was not only leveraging the San Francisco progressiveness of technology and, moving quick, but also really at their core had a pedagogical stance that they were really viewing children and learning the way that I was viewing it. And so I found Altitude Learning, and my role there as their head of partnerships now is that I, connect with schools and districts, and I understand where they currently are in their learning model and how they may want to shift towards a model that's more learner-centered, which I guess we'll unpack the definition of that a little bit. But, that's the long-winded story of started in the East Coast girl, and now I'm San Francisco for life.
Nice. So,
yeah.
I was, I love that. I love your kind of story and how you kind of move through this discovery process of what's, important to you as an educator. Just curious, since before we get into the meat of the topics, how would you relate your experiences growing up and going to school to kind of, how that kind of shaped where you are today as an educator?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think, there was something that was, they were in tension, my two learning experiences. I had one in a, you know, more traditional classroom where, you know, we were sitting in rows. The educator was the beholder of all the knowledge. We took it all in and then we regurgitated it out. And then right after I would leave this more traditional model of school, I would go right to my dance studio. So at my dance studio, I was spending days from 2 to 7 p.m. learning from someone who understood me as a human. We would move together. We would grow together. I felt like she knew my dance teachers knew my interests and my loves of life. And so they would foster me and nurture me in a way that I felt like wasn't always happening in the classroom. I mean, granted it did some years and some not, but I think that I really see the role of an educator through the lens of my dance teacher, which is that an educator is more of a coach, a mentor, a guide than it is like a sage on the stage. And so I think that that is how I tried to be as an educator, where I wasn't always in the front of the room. I was with my students and I wanted to be that mentor and that coach more than I wanted to be the smartest person in the room or the only person that knew certain things. And that, I feel like that's how it's shaped me the most. Yeah.
I think that you kind of hit on something really interesting in terms of like where you felt most heard and respected and excited was in the dance studio, where it was somewhere that you were pursuing your passion and pursuing an interest of yours. And in the classroom, perhaps not as much as we should have that aspect of pursuing your passions. And I think that kind of what you've talked about in terms of, we can get now a little bit into the learner-centered model, is this idea that instead of being the sage on the stage, as you said, if we're there to help our students find their passions, they don't have to be in dance studios necessarily to find that. They could be in your traditional classroom and still find something that intrigues them and be able to build on that and grow that and have that be what makes their education come to life. And so I'm curious if you can talk about how you, it sounds like part of your mission too and the work that you do is to try to make that a reality. And so I'm curious how that's come to play in your work right now.
Yeah. So I think the way that is bubbling up now in the work that I do is I think it's a bit of that mindset shift from the highest levels of a district to, you know, the educator in the classroom, really understanding what the role of the educator is and what the role of the learner is. And if we start to ask ourselves, who's working the hardest in the classroom? It's typically the educator. And so it's starting to dismantle that and say, what if we're working side by side and we co-own our space and we co-own our learning experiences? And I think this is where you start to get into the idea of learner agency or learner centered, where I think you're starting to take apart this system that we've tried to shove learners into. And you're saying, actually, let's put the learners at the center and create the system around the learner. And so if you do that, then you're starting to say, okay, if the learner's at the center, that means their interests, their passions, their individual needs, that's where we're starting. We're not starting with the system or the curriculum. And so I think it's a whole reorientation to learning. And I know that sounds really like overwhelming at times. It feels like, you know, how can we shift our whole philosophy about learning? But I think getting back to that original idea of just saying, okay, well, who's working the hardest in the classroom? If it's the educator, let's start there. How can your students do just as much work as you? And that starts to shift just the ownership of a classroom, right? You can think about class jobs as a way that many educators already do this. What are the ways that you're kind of dishing out responsibilities? How can you do that that's focused on their passions, right? How can you do that that's focused on like what they really care about? I think that's one way.
Yeah, and I think that what you're talking about in terms of the mindset shift and the reorientation, it's almost like the stars are aligning, so to speak. I mean, not that we would ever want to look for a silver lining in something as horrific as this pandemic that we're in, but it has forced the entire educational world to pause and to really examine, who are we? What are we actually trying to do? What are our goals? And so I'm curious what you're noticing in terms of now that that mindset shift and that reorientation almost is forced upon us, what have you been experiencing with the districts that you're talking to now, with the teachers that you're talking with? I'm curious about that experience currently.
Yeah, great question. So here's the thing, right? We were jolted into an emergency triage situation where educators were given little to no time to basically take a model that has been designed for in-class learning and put it all online. And I think, you know, once we got through the initial shock of that, of like, let me just learn how to even shift my classroom to be online fully, then you're starting to ask questions of like, okay, do my learners know how to learn on their own? So then I started having teachers say to me, you know, Kels, I'm doing it. Everything's online. But what I'm realizing is that the system has faulted my students in that they don't know how to guide their own learning. They're sitting, they're showing up, they're looking at the laptop, they're ready to engage, but they, without someone standing over their shoulder or without, you know, everyone turned to page 144 on this minute of this day, without that kind of guidance, we're quickly realizing that a lot of our learners did not develop those soft skills to navigate learning on their own. So now what you see is educators who have already had to do a ton of work to move online now have to shift, like you were saying, like, you know, we're doing that reorientation to say, okay, now how am I giving my learners more opportunities to drive their own learning? Because I can't be there and I shouldn't be there. They should be driving their own learning. And so I think that is one way that it's come up more immediately. I would say in the spring, that was something that came up. I think the thing that I'm seeing more this fall was people kind of took a big deep breath over the summer for about 2 days. And then they were like, all right, now we got to get ready for the fall. And what we kind of, we took away from the educators in the schools in the fall was that we didn't have to report assessment. We didn't have to, you know, it was a lot of pass fail, a lot of go, no go, right? We didn't have to really give assessment because of this like emergency situation. But now some districts are saying, okay, did you get enough of a foothold over the summer that we can continue to do this remote learning in the fall, but now we're going to hold you accountable to assessment. Now this takes it to a whole nother level because you're starting to see the system work against itself because the system was set up to have what we were originally talking about, which was I'm the beholder of knowledge. I'm going to share that knowledge with you. And you have to share it back to me in a very specific form, like a quiz or this perfect essay with this, you know, this checklist. And I'm going to give you a grade based on that. Right now you're seeing if you're able to Google the answer or if you're able to look up the answer, you know, you can't give that type of assessment anymore. So we're seeing that teachers are now being held accountable for assessment, but not necessarily always given the tools to navigate from more of a traditional assessment model to more of what I would call a competency-based assessment model. I mean, we can unpack that a little bit more if you'd like to, what competency-based assessment really means. And so when I think about competency-based assessment, I think about assessment that shows competency, right? It's not a one-time deal. And what I mean by that is I was raised in a classroom where we would finish chapter one of math on addition and you would get your chapter one test and you would score an 87 and that was it. And you were never allowed to show your knowledge of addition again because we moved on to subtraction. And what competency-based assessment says is actually, we're going to allow you to try it once, try it twice, try it three times, and continue to build your understanding of a concept over a longer period of time. What it also says is that we're going to give you different types of opportunities to show that learning. So for me, I'm a very visual learner. So if I were to show you how I believe I'm competent in addition, I would be showing you through visuals. But maybe, you know, another a peer in my classroom is more of a writer, and maybe they're writing a word problem out about addition and showing their competency that way. And I think, you know, the third piece is that we are starting to do away with more of the points based and the letter grades. And we're starting to, I keep using the word dismantle, but it is what we're doing. We're doing a lot of dismantling the traditional grading model to say, let's do it on a scale that makes sense for learners, right? Those numbers don't really mean much. So let's give them a scale that really helps them understand where they're at. And so, for example, you know, a scale that I often see is like emerging, practicing, meeting, or advanced. So I am performing an assessment task on addition, and then my teacher says, you know what, you're practicing here. Here are the other ways I'd like you to show your evidence of that. Now, you can't Google that. I can't Google how to show my teacher. I mean, maybe you could and something would pop up, but you still have to do the performance task. You still have to show your competency of the standard, of the, you know, performance task. And so that, you know, I talked a bit about the spring, about, you know, learner agency, but what I'm really seeing this fall is we're nearing, for some of our schools, we're nearing that first grading period, and they're starting to give, or the questions around quizzes and unit tests is coming up, and we're having to rethink the ways that we provide assessments to students.
Yeah, I think there's some, what started percolating as you were talking about that with competency-based learning is, I mean, first of all, someone can become competent in something in a vastly, like you said, vastly different time period, and also become competent in something with, you know, none of the instruction that any of the teachers in the school provide. You know, that's kind of like, you know, this little dark secret that people that don't go to school can become very well, you know, wonderful people in society. And there's another, I think, element to softening the grading scale, like you mentioned, because when it is a number grade, you know, and letter grades are so correlated with numbers, it's, you know, it's like the same. It's literally, once you get here, you've gotten 100 out of 100. And I don't think people realize how significantly what message that sends. It's like, you're done.
Exactly. And I think that it instills the wrong message, right? The message is, you're always learning. You're never going to reach this level that it's like, yep, I'm done with that. And I'm moving on. There's always something new to be learned. And another way to grow. Just as a learner.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting how I think, you know, a lot of educators don't learn about latent learning in teaching school often, which is that kids are learning things all the time, even if it has nothing to do with information. So you're learning that there's a cap to how you can achieve of what you can achieve. And you're learning that you only have one chance to do something right and then you fail. And we know that was a major intention in school formation, was to condition that in. I think the word dismantling, I mean, I think, you know, revolution is the right word almost for what should be happening. What I like about student-centric learning is that it at least starts to kind of like create some movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, the other piece that we haven't touched on yet, but I think is really like the third peg of the three-legged stool. It's like learner agency, and then there's like your assessment, but then it's what I really like to focus on is like authenticity. And authenticity, not only in the learning experience, but authenticity in who your audience is. Like really giving learners an opportunity to produce things that they can see in the world. You know, I think we've all done the research paper for nonfiction on your favorite animal, right? One more step there would be, let's look at a real organization that's looking at animals or researching animals. If you were to produce this paper for them, how would that change how you really own that project, or how you care about that project, or how you could see it impacting the world? And I think to me, those three things really make up a new type of learning model. It's giving students the tools in the audience, which is like that authentic experience. And then it's giving them the agency. I shouldn't say giving them, having students reclaim their agency. And then I think it's, how do we assess that? And how do we know how they're progressing on the scale that we've created? And what input do students have along the way to critique and be curious about that scale that they're being assessed on? And then the most radical is like, why aren't they creating the scale that they get assessed on? And so, you know, that's where I like to go, is like all the way to the other side, where kids are the principals for a month and they get to run their school. But yeah, I think with remote learning, you know, to tie it back, I think with remote learning, you're seeing, you know, our educators who we already ask so much of, and we've set them up in a system that is not serving them in the way that it needs to, nor is it serving our students and families. But now we're asking them to shift again to this new model. But I do think with the learner-centered model, it is kind of a light at the end of the tunnel, because going back to my original point, we're going to be working equally in the classroom. It is not, the burden now is not totally on the educator. Of course, up front it is, but it's this idea of shared space and shared learning over time.
It also speaks to the goals that we're trying to achieve, right? Like you said, the kind of silliness of the way that we assessed is being called into question just simply by having Google now at students' fingertips at all times, right? And so you're talking about like the authenticity, it goes to like, what are we actually trying to achieve as well? What do we want our students to be able to do at the end of a unit? If it's just to do 10 problems on a worksheet, what's the real value in that? You know, there's no workspace that I know that is like, okay, tomorrow we're going to get a really big contract if you guys can just complete this worksheet, you know, within the next 5 minutes, you know, and you only have 10 questions here to complete this worksheet. And so I think, again, it's like, what are our goals? What are we really trying to have accomplished, and what are we trying to achieve? And so I'm curious, you know, where you're seeing that authenticity play out in the goals as well, and what we're actually able to see it become possible in the achievements as well for students.
Yeah, so I'll talk a little about, you know, I haven't really talked a ton about where I work right now, but I will talk a little bit about some of the origin story, because I think it is really interesting. And what's interesting about it is, you know, we are smack dab in the middle of like some of the most progressive companies in the world, arguably, in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. And we have access to people in some of these companies, you know, like a Google, like we had mentioned. And part of the origins of Altitude Learning was going to these companies and saying, what skills do you want in the people that come and work for you? And it's not compliance. It's not obedience. It's creativity. It's risk taking. It's problem solving. It's critical thinking. And if you start all the way there, you know, a little tangent is, of course, like, you know, college and career, we can decide which path is right for each person. But if we really look at some of the organizations who are doing arguably some of the most important work in the world, and we say, what type of human do you want showing up for their first day of work? And we start to back plan from there. And then we say, okay, in what ways do our, you know, I like to call them learner profiles. So if we're looking at a school, and they are, you know, oftentimes it's called like a graduate profile, and you're asking, what type of human do we want to produce, right? And I know that's a pretty vast question, but it is a workshop that I lead oftentimes. And the words that come up are global citizen, problem solver, agent, activist. And if that's your end goal, and if that's organization's end goal, what are you doing to get there? And underneath those, there's some of those like learning targets. And you can really start to pick apart each one of those goals, like you were saying, into very tangible skills, whether it's, you know, a soft skill or a hard skill. And I think, you know, these big ideas that we have often quickly become really attainable when we can start to pick apart these, you know, like you were saying, pick apart these goals.
Yeah, I think I'm just like, there's so much to digest with that, right? Because it's, I'm almost tired of reading the same article that talks about how there's the disconnect between the high school senior graduating and the college freshman coming in, and the connection between the college senior graduating and the entry-level professionals. And so I'd love for you to even go further with kind of what you're talking about. You said you went to these companies and you were asking them, but then what did that process look like? Once you get these concepts, these big ideas of what they're actually trying to find and trying to have come to fruition in their workers, what's that process look like? And how do you actually, like, if you could get into some of that, the actual back planning that did happen there, I'd be fascinated to kind of hear, how do you take that knowledge and then actually create that systems around it?
Well, I wish I was there. I wasn't there. So I don't have the perfect answer because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't part of the co-founding team. But you know, I'd be happy to talk through some examples of the high schools I work with. You know, no, I think that they are addressing some of these, the exact disconnect that you're getting at is that, you know, oftentimes in these districts, you're graduating students that have a profile that you're not necessarily proud of. We're looking at, you know, the score on the state test as like, you know, the biggest indicator of who they are as humans, not, you know, how did they do progressing towards being a global citizen? So one organization that I really love and admire is Big Picture Learning. And Big Picture Learning does a lot of work with schools all over the country and the world to ask that exact same question of, you know, what type of student do you want to graduate? And I think the voice that we often lose when we are creating those models is the voice of the community and the voice of the students and the families. And so, you know, one high school that I work with, you know, I went down to work with them in Southern California, and we spent the day with families, with their incoming class, to have this exact discussion of what type of citizen do you want leaving our high school and going into your community. And I wish I had, you know, I know you won't be able to see me, but like we had all these big posters around the room, and we're writing out all the different things of, you know, I keep reiterating very similar ones, but global citizen, problem solver, critical thinker, activist, et cetera. And then similar to what I shared before, but you're kind of taking those and then you're saying, but what does that really mean? What does that look like? What does that feel like? Okay, now that if that's our starting place, what does our classroom look like? And how are these values that we've co-created reflected in the classroom? And I know that I've been a little doom and gloom today about all the changes that we need to make, but I would say like people are waking up to this, like people are doing it. And I think that that is like, what's really exciting about my job is, you know, because my organization so closely associates with the pedagogical beliefs of being learner-centered, I really get to connect with schools that are about to take the jump and they just need the support in taking those next steps. And so I, you know, coast to coast, we have schools that we're working with who are saying, and specifically being magnified by remote learning, like now is the time. Like now is the time, especially because, you know, in the fall, we got to throw out standardized assessment. I'm making a prediction that we're going to do it again, but I don't want to, you know, you're hearing it first. But I do think that we are not going to be holding our kids to the same standard that we have in the past. So if there's a time to do it, I feel like right now is the time. Right now is the time to like take the risk and, you know, like shift your classroom. Now I'm sounding like I'm like, and sign up here to come into your classroom.
I, as we were just in the last few minutes there, kind of was thinking about, you know, how does this look in, you know, a year or two when, you know, in the ideal future? And I think, you know, I would even want to push it a little further because I think one of the things that's still alive in student-centric learning and learning profiling is it still smells a little eugenics-y, you know, like school is. It's still a little bit like, well, wait a second, what do the children want? And what do people who are allowed to think for themselves want? And so I think there's an interesting both opportunity in the future to, that's the first time I've said something smells eugenics-y, but I've been going deep down the tunnel on how the current progressive movement is still part of that, which is kind of weird, but,
yeah.
But anyway, it's real, I think. You know, how, what are the pieces that we're able to be exploring now with, you know, removing standardized assessment at the level that most people recognize as standardization, standardized tests and things like that, and some of the new ways of assessing that are sort of coming out of necessity, as I think, I don't know if we've talked about on the episode, but even just talking about, you know, because of online learning necessitating assessment that's not as Googleable and things like that, you know, so how do we, and I guess, how do you, Kelsey, kind of envision the ideal integration taking place in a couple of years of like painting this new picture? Just a small question.
Yeah. And I wish I had a great answer. And in a few years, what do I envision? Well, you know, I think, Josh, you started to tap into, we have this disconnect from the organizations to our high school graduates. And I think something right in the middle of that are our universities. And our universities are starting to wake up to this. Like, you're seeing the UC system change their admissions process. You're seeing universities say you can submit a portfolio of work. They're ditching SAT scores. They're ditching some of these more traditional measures of success because they do not have any correlation to what type of human you're going to become. And then you have the pressure of the organizations that they're putting on these universities to say, you know, your graduates are showing up without the skills that we want them to have. And so in a few years, what I hope is during this time of chaos, we have some real tangible success stories that we can say, well, look how it worked here. Are we able to expand that? I think, I'm not sure if I'm able to expand more. I think right now, I mean, just I'm in survival mode still over here. Yeah. So like I haven't thought about a few years out in a while.
Well, let me ask it this way, because I think we can still stay in the present to kind of get there. And that is, you know, and I also think I'm always accused of layering questions. So here we go. But I think there's kind of an interesting thing that's happening, which is that, you know, that would be curious to think about is the educators that are now teaching online who were trained 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago was when I went to school and we didn't talk about any of this stuff. You know, what are the things that are starting to click for them now that you're like, ooh, this is kind of cool. Like, this could really go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for me, it has to be the shift of power. It has to be the shift of power in the classroom. And I think I have seen real tension and real hesitancy and skepticism to turning over the keys to kids, to giving them the keys to the castle. And some ways that that's showing up, I can share. For example, goal setting. Oftentimes, educators are setting goals for students. What would it look like for students to set and track their own goals? I think that is starting to happen more universally. You're seeing that more universally across our schools. So that is one way that we're starting to shift the power dynamics to say students can set and track their own goals. Okay, great. Now the next one is like, how do we create our curriculum and our projects? And what would it look like for you to co-create that alongside your students? And I have some teachers who are feeling like me when I was teaching. You know, I needed, my orientation to teaching was truly a training that said you need to be in lockstep with the teacher who's teaching first grade next to you. I quote you, I should be able to walk between your classroom and her classroom and I should hear the exact same lesson at the exact same time. I kid you not. That is how I was trained to teach. So if I was still in the classroom, I think I'd be feeling the same way. Why? Because people I really trusted and respected in the education community were telling me that this was the best way to teach. And so now someone else is saying to me, oh no, you got to blow that up. you got to just create something that your students are interested in. Yeah, they'll master things along the way. They're going to learn along the way. That's what you need to kind of be the guide and the mentor. You don't need to be the sage on the stage. That is a really hard shift. You're really releasing power, releasing control. And it's messy. It is not as easy. It's so much easier to say, turn to this page on this day and do this math lesson. So the sparks for me, the light bulbs for me have been when educators see a much more meaningful, impactful, revolutionary learning experience happening because they let go of control. Because they said, how the heck am I going to teach this over a computer? Okay, I need to go to my kids and we're going to co-create something. And then when that end product or that experience is better, okay, that's a data point, right? That's a data point to say, okay, I released control and it turned out better. How might I do this in another part of my classroom?
Yeah, I think you really pointed to one of the core issues, which is the fear. And that is not just fear that's happenstance of like, oh no, things might go wrong. That's like programmed fear into the psyche of teachers that actually, and this is, you know, part of my story is after really reading about the history of school, it was a book called Weapons of Mass Instruction. It came out around 2001. It was like, you know, those other fake weapons of mass destruction. But anyway, John Taylor Gatto, New York City school teacher, resigned via an op-ed in the Washington Post and was like, you're all criminals, basically. And I read that book and I left my teaching job. I was teaching in DC and it was very lockstep. And I was like, oh, it is based on the Prussian military. And I'm like to me, I was like, this is kind of child abuse. And so I think there's, you know, I think there's a healing for educators to actually step into handing over power or becoming co-creators is also kind of, you know, forces kind of this like looking like accepting a past fully that may have been not what they thought it was as what they were actually doing in the classroom.
And I think the other thing that's scary is I think, you know, you shared the teacher's fear, but also students. I think students who have been in the system for a long enough time, I mean, truly a year or two, right, is a lot of time. If you ask them, it's just this fear that students have that if I'm going to have power in my classroom, someone's going to be critical of me or judgmental of me. And so I think that that is also scary. And then in the reverse way, educators, if you say to an educator, and I would have felt the same way, I want my students to feel super powerful in their classroom or empowered. Most teachers would be like, absolutely, right? And then when you ask them what opportunities you're giving your students to feel empowered, it's often like, well, they get to choose the animal that they do their research project on. And that's not true co-creation. That is like, yeah, a very limited scope of where the power dynamic has shifted.
Well, I want to come back to, because it's been harping in my mind here, the words that you said earlier were, it's like, I don't want to be all doom and gloom. And I think that that's kind of also a misnomer because, you know, when you say like we need to dismantle these systems and we need to think about how we shift the mindsets, to me, that's actually a really exciting and empowering thing. It's not a doom and gloom in any way for me, because what we're really saying and at the core of it is that we're trying to understand that it's not what we're perceiving as a loss, but it's actually what we're gaining. And I think what we gain when we make this shift is so much more than we could ever possibly quote unquote lose by having a shift away from traditional schooling and traditional way of teaching. Because when you have students that are actually, like you said, impassioned and excited about what they're learning and taking ownership over their learning and feeling agency in the classroom and wanting to be able to explain what they're learning, you know, I think that you're really getting to the crux of what education should be and what we're trying to accomplish. And so I do want to just kind of make that point of, I wouldn't say doom and gloom, I would say exciting optimism. And really that's the way that I hope that we can frame it so that we can make that change that you're saying, that what do we see in a year or two, or what do we see in 5 years? Is by having this language be from, as we say in our podcast name, by amplifying the optimism of it, we're really able to examine where we can go. And so I do want to have that reframe and kind of get your reaction to that reframe on that.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be in the role that I'm in right now if I didn't have hope. I think, you know, the thing that gives me hope is, you know, what I had mentioned was the schools that I'm already talking to, the schools that are doing this, the first graders that are co-creating learning with their teachers at six. I think, you know, sometimes we just don't give our kids enough credit. They are so brilliant and they want to learn. Like you had mentioned, Michael, they're learning all the time anyway. They know how to do this. They know how to go on YouTube and learn how to bake cookies. They know how to build a fort. They know, you know, like they know some of these like inherent foundational skills that we don't give them credit for, or allow them to bring to the classroom. And so, yeah, of course, I am really hopeful. I am really excited about, you know, what the future holds for education and, you know, just the fact that more schools are even using some of this language to better understand what assessment practices are. You know, that wasn't a conversation up until recently. And the fact that we're even examining the role of students in the classroom or examining the role of the educator gives me hope that while it is a huge ship that we're moving, that it is moving, you know, centimeter by centimeter. And at all levels, we're starting to see people wake up to that philosophy.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I'm curious to like, what would be if I was a teacher who was like, okay, I tried to let my students have agency and sovereignty over their learning and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what would your pep talk be to that educator? You know, and knowing, you know, I think what we know is that it's because they, you know, a lot of teachers are actually more instructors than educators, you mm-hmm. know, and.
Yeah. It's a great question. And I usually do start with something like, well, first let's acknowledge, thank you for trying, right? Thank you for trying to shift the power dynamic in your classroom. You are not just an instructor, you are an artist and you are tapping into being a 21st century knowledge worker like educators should be. And so first it's just appreciation for, we have given you a ton and you're still willing to try more, right? Just in the profession of being an educator. And then I think the second one is a conversation about their own learning. I often start with when were you really excited to learn something? You know, those nights where you can't go to sleep and you're up all night learning about something and you're insatiable until you reach a certain point that you know enough about X, Y, or Z. What does that feel like? What does that look like? And you quickly see someone who's down in the dumps get really excited about the last time they learned how to like preserve cherries or whatever, like the last thing they got so pumped about, and they're telling you how excited they are. And now they're handing them out as gifts to all their friends and they're learning how to now do peaches. And it's become this whole hobby. Okay. Amazing. What was really meaningful about that? And here are the things that pop up. I had resources. I had an expert. I got real-time feedback. I screwed up the first batch. So these are the changes I made. So what I start to do usually on like a little post-it is I'm making notes as this person's telling me like, well, what made it meaningful? Why did you succeed? And so then we usually end up with a list that's like, these are the things that really helped me as a learner. And so then we start to take the messy learning that happened in their classroom. And I would probably argue that it wasn't as much of a failure as they probably feel, because as educators, it's like, you know, it's like batting. You're like failing most of the time, but you're still amazing. And I would take this post-it of the things that they were doing. And most of the time there is a crosswalk there, right? There is like things that they did that made amazing learning experiences. And then there are opportunities to continue to grow. And the other thing I would say is like teaching is so isolating and you are in a silo with, you know, at one point I was teaching 31 first graders on my own. So I was with 31 6-year-olds from 7 to 4. And I, you know, you go home and you're just so wiped and you can't really talk to it about it, like about it with and many people that understand. And maybe you have a PD once a week, and maybe you meet with your team once a week. But I would say, with moving most things online, things that are exploding right now are the online community of educators. And I would say, like, you know, I would ask that teacher, like, what opportunities are you giving yourself to connect with others who are trying this messy learning with you? And for me personally, like, community is always something that helps me when I'm feeling down. And so, yeah, that's probably, you know, that's probably what I would say is, you're not alone. You probably didn't fail as much as you think you did, and you're still amazing.
I like that. I'm like, ooh, this is all good for when I'm talking to educators. Good ideas.
Yeah, I think that it's a powerful message. I think that's one that, as educators, we don't often hear enough. We don't often say it enough. We don't often acknowledge enough that, like you said, it is messy, but if we are truly to make the change we want to see in our education systems and truly trying to put our students first and really making that impactful change, then we have to be able to be part of a community that's working together to help to sustain it. And so I know we are, you know, coming up here on time. We could just keep talking for hours. This is so exciting. Your passion is showing through. And I think, you know, our listeners will really enjoy the excitement in your voice and your practical steps and knowledge here. So I just want to leave it and turn it over to you in terms of, like, are there things that you just really want to make sure that you get across, or things that you haven't necessarily shared, or is there any other pieces, tidbits, wisdoms that you really are like, you know, I just have to say this. It doesn't have to necessarily be sequential to it, but I'm just curious where you're landing right now and things that you're thinking about.
Yeah, I think if I were to reiterate anything again, it would be just that last piece, and it really is just thanking our educators. I never want to be in a position where I've become jaded from how hard the teaching profession is. I just want to thank educators if they're listening, and if they're not listening, educators out there, I feel like we have tasked them with a near impossible job, and they are just soaring with it and being, like, you know, so adaptable. And I think that paired with the hopefulness of the learner-centered movement. And I would say if you don't know much about it, Google it. I won't give you a quiz on it, but you will progress in your competency-based understanding of learner-centered, and I would love to have a conversation. So let's keep chatting about it.
And how do our listeners continue that conversation with you? How can they get in touch and follow this conversation?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. It's probably the best place. It's just KelseyPayne_ED. And that's where I connect with a lot of my educators and my team.
Excellent.
Thank you, Kelsey. I'm going to start following you on Twitter.
Yes, great. Indeed. Well, thank you so much for having me. You know, it was really great to have this conversation. And, you know, I'm even leaving today more hopeful. I think it's just so nice to even just verbalize and revisit some of those passions, yeah, starting with, you know, yeah, your earliest experiences in education and seeing where you've ended up now.
Thank you. That's always our goal. So we love to leave more optimistic than when we started. So thank you so much, Kelsey, for joining us. And thank you for sharing your knowledge, your excitement, and your wisdom here in this subject.
Josh and I hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode of Amplifying Optimism in Education. Please join us next week for another new episode and conversation with an innovative educator from around the world.